Thank you very much, Bill. I understand from Monty that I'm the last speaker before you guys get to leave and have a few drinks and find out who wins $250 worth of ethanol, right? Is that the end? So I'm going to try not to to keep you very long, but I do want to share some thoughts with you. And if you're interested, I would be interested in taking some questions from you about this issue or, frankly, anything else that you'd like to talk about. Monty, I appreciate, and Walter, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and get a chance to talk to you about an issue that's very important to me. And this is how I look at the issue of ethanol and renewable energy, and particularly liquid fuels produced domestically. I look at it as a national security issue. And I say that as someone who, and on occasion, did some battles with your great senator from Iowa, Chuck Grassley. I served on the Ag Committee. I was the first Pennsylvania. I'm from Pennsylvania. I was the first Pennsylvania to serve on the Ag Committee in the United States Senate in over 100 years, believe it or not. And yet Pennsylvania's number one industry during most of that time was agriculture. But I served on the Ag Committee and actually spent a lot of time and energy working on those issues for the interest of my state. And I was informed by several people out there that, yes, Pennsylvania grows a lot of corn. And, yes, we are doing on a very, very small scale in Pennsylvania what you're doing here and have been doing here in Iowa for quite some time. But I looked at through the Ag Committee and then subsequently working with Chuck on the Finance Committee, I looked at this issue differently until 9/11. To me, 9/11 changed the game in Washington, D.C., and hopefully changed the game for the country as we look at energy production in this country. You saw in the last election cycle a lot of folks saying, I'm for everything. I'm for all sorts of energy. And that is a nice thing to say, but the question is, how do you make that happen? And our country was attacked by a group of people who hail from a specific area of the world. And that area of the world is an area of the world that we are dependent on for a very large portion. We're 60% dependent on foreign oil, and a big chunk of that, the majority of that, comes from the Middle East. And from my perspective, I looked at over the course of a couple years, I did a little reading of history. If there's one thing I don't think we do a lot of in this country is look at our current situation from a historical perspective. And I look at the people who attacked us, radical Islamists, people who wanted to spread their version of Islam all around the world, to in fact conquer the world for Islam. That's what they believe. That's what motivates them. And you can say, well, it's just a small fringe group of people. But look at your history. The history of the conflict between the West, Western civilization, and Islam is one of 1,000 years of war. 1,000 years of war. 1,000 years where Islam was ever expanding their borders into and taking over areas of Western civilization. If you go back into the early days of Christendom, if you will, some of the greatest teachers and scholars of the early church came from Egypt, North Africa. St. Augustine was from Hippo in North Africa. If you look at the church, again, the Christendom in the Eastern Church, Constantine and Constantinople in Turkey, all of that over that 1,000-year period of time changed as Islam expanded through force into Western Europe, into Central Europe, until it was pushed back. It was pushed back a little over 300 years ago. It was in the mid-1600s where the high water mark of Islam, if you will. Now, why do I say that as a background? Well, for 300 years after that period of time, Islam was relegated to a very small area of the world. It expanded into South Asia and into the Southeast Asia. But with respect to the West, Islam was no longer a threat. Radical Islam, whatever you want to call it, was no longer a threat. Why? Because the West passed by. The West developed technologically, scholastically, and otherwise, and was able to build and embrace modernity and build a great civilization. And that area of the world dominated, that Middle Eastern area of the world, that Muslim area of the world, could not and did not keep up. And for 300 years, there was, by all accounts, no threat And then something happened. A three-letter word happened, and things changed. That three-letter word was oil. We would not have been attacked on 9/11 had it not been for oil. We would not be in the dominant position that we have to be in the Middle East but for the national security interest of our country, the economic security interest of our country. And I believe that threat is an existential threat to Western civilization because of resources. It's not because that area of the world is competing with us on any other level. It's because they're sitting on huge reserves of oil that, because of the development of this country and the rest of the world, is becoming more and more valuable, as we see by looking at our markets today. And so I suggest to you that as Americans, we need to look at how we are going to blunt and thwart this threat to the security of our country. And the obvious answer is to deprive it of the resources to be able to be a threat. And the way you do that is by reducing the demand for the product that they want to sell and that they can sell for their benefit. And so post 9/11, I went from someone who was skeptical at best of developing domestic sources of energy to being a grand proponent of such things and believe that not only is it something that we have to do for an economic purpose, and I read all the literature about what ethanol means to the economy of Iowa and biodiesel means to the economy of other states in this state. I accept all those economic arguments. But for me, the preeminent one, as someone who's kicking around looking at the 2012 presidential, is national security and the threat to this country. And the folks here in the breadbasket of America can do a lot and a lot more if the government creates a marketplace for the fuels that you want to produce. And so my suggestion or my pledge to you is to work with this industry to create a bigger and bigger place in the market for domestically produced ethanol biodiesel. I come from Western Pennsylvania. I was just talking to a good friend of mine. He's an oil driller, oil and gas driller. And he told me straight up last week, he said, I wouldn't be drilling my wells right now if it wasn't for a tax credit that allows me to do this. No one seems to complain too much about the tax credit to help the oil and gas industry. And yet everyone seems to focus on the ethanol industry as some sort of illegitimate tax credit. Now, the tax credit may not be, in my opinion, where it should be right now. But the bottom line is, I have no problem with creating an incentive to make sure that we have a stable and thriving industry in this country to produce liquid fuels. I believe in energy. My grandfather was a coal miner. He actually mined coal in a deep mine till he was 72 years old. So I believe in energy. I believe in our ability to create it here and thrive as an economy because of it. If you look at my final comment on the energy thing is, if you look at the world and look at its level of prosperity, and you match up a chart with the level of prosperity in the country and the level of energy consumption in that country, they match over identically. The idea that we can produce and use less energy and be more prosperous simply does not comport with the facts. The bottom line is, if America is going to continue to grow and prosper, if Americans are going to continue to increase their standard of living, we are going to have to increase the amount of energy that we produce in this country, period. Or we will become stagnant or decline. So I would just say to all of you here, thank you for, in many cases, I know a lot of people here were pioneers who went through the difficult times, and I know in recent times a lot of folks have been through some difficult times in the biodiesel area. But I want to congratulate you for stepping forward and for persevering. I want to congratulate, it's a hard thing for me to do, Chuck Grassley I want to congratulate Chuck Grassley for the fights that he's fought on your behalf. And I want to say to you that I look forward to working with you in the future to make sure that we become an energy-independent country for the security of our country and for a strong economy and prosperity of our people. I'd be happy to stop and take whatever questions that you might have. I know I'm the last speaker, so. Oh, you have. Okay. Do you want to ask a question? Go ahead.
Please. Senator, can you explain to us why it is that non-Midwest congressmen, you know, are in such opposition to ethanol for a variety of reasons, but they really don't want to have a discussion about oil? You know, obviously, our industry points out a lot of the negative aspects of oil, but in Congress, it seems like it's kind of a one-sided debate oftentimes, and wondered if you could help us understand
why.
Yeah,
I think part of it, I can speak for me. I'm not too sure I can speak for others. I can speak for me. I think part of it was early in the, and I came into Congress in the early 90s, and part of it was this, you know, we weren't quite sure that this was real, that this was not just another way, you know, for another farm subsidy. And as you know, I mean, there certainly was no end of farm subsidies when I came to the United States Congress. And so I just tell you, for me, I just sort of thought, well, this is a sort of a new idea. It didn't sound like at the time it was a particularly efficient way of creating fuel. And we looked like it was going to have to heavily subsidize it sort of forever, and it didn't really make sense. That we had the old argument, well, you know, what's this going to do to the grain markets, and what's this going to do for livestock feed? And there were all these arguments out there that just sort of it was a whole credibility issue. We knew, well, why do we support oil and gas drilling? Well, because we know if we do that, we'll get more oil and gas, and we know that that works. What we didn't know whether that we could produce this commodity, we could transport it, it could be used in vehicles, all of the things that were uncertain that sort of led to that skepticism as to why we're continuing to do that. I can tell you that's where I was coming from. And not that you haven't addressed a lot of those issues over time, and I know the process has gotten more efficient over time, but I throw in the fact that we weren't in the national security position, certainly when I came in. The Soviet Union had fallen. You know, why we need more, you know, world was stable, we in control, everything was fine as far as why do we need to invest more money in something? Well, I ran in the same situation with a guy who, a group of folks who wanted to turn coal into liquid fuels in Pennsylvania. They came to me and asked for some money. I said, no. I said, we don't need to do this. And I was wrong. Looking at what happened in 9/11, I was wrong. In fact, after 9/11, I turned around and said, okay, I'll support you doing this. So I worked to try to get incentives for coal and gas to liquid fuels, and got grant awards from the Department of Energy. So I just think that there was a different time, and the fact that you had a fledgling industry that was unproven in many respects certainly was damaging. And that's why I said at the end of my talk, I give a lot of credit to folks who had a lot more vision than I did when I was first voting on this issue. Anybody from the other side? We'll go
Senator,
back here.
I may be a few years older than you, but I hope you can remember the oil embargo of 74. You know, prior to 74, there wasn't really much talk about energy independence, but that really kind of, you know, when you have to wait in line, if your plate's an even number, you can only buy gas on days that are even numbered. So what, I'm a patient person, but 35 years later, OPEC hasn't gone away. We've got reserves in Alaska. We've got oil reserves in Alaska. We've got coal out west. I think we've even got some capped oil wells in Texas and Oklahoma.
We got a lot of oil out west, too.
And the military finds nuclear as a source for aircraft carriers.
Submarines.
Why is it that we, in 2011, are still so dependent on this oil from the Mideast?
Well, it's a combination of environmentalists, which of course is a problem for this industry because of the caps on production because of the environmentalists. But look, it is the environmental movement of this country that has hamstrung our ability to get to energy independence. And I always say to the environmentalists, if you're really concerned about the environment, not your backyard, but the environment, then you would want the United States of America to develop every natural resource and to produce as much fuel as we can, because we will do it cleaner than anybody else in the world. And so instead of having us drill oil in Alaska or or gas wells off the coast of California. We have, you know, the Russians do it, and we see the economic devastation that occurs on a regular basis. Or the Chinese do things with respect to their energy production. And they don't have the environmental regulations. They don't have the concern about, you know, doing it in a way that that's efficient and safe and environmentally sound. So I lay it squarely there, and we have a president with an EPA that is going to make it harder and harder. They're shutting down, and the Interior Department just a few weeks ago, right before Christmas, shut down another portion of land for mining and drilling. And I think that's going to continue with this administration. He is very much tied to the environmental movement. So they aren't going to get cap and trade, thanks be to God, but they're going to try other things to try to reduce energy production in this country and thereby have some way of controlling energy consumption, controlling it by increasing the price. Yes.
I think we have time for one more, so I'll do it. A little bit of a statement, and if you'd like to comment on it, that'd be great. One of the themes that folks have talked about here throughout the day is if we're going to achieve some of these goals that you're talking about, we've got to change our vehicle fleet. Right now, you know, most of the vehicles sold are only capable of running on E10, soon E15, but that still is only a small step in the right direction. We need to get more flexible fuel vehicles that can go up to E85. It doesn't require a consumer to use E85, but it gives them, the consumer, the choice. And I know in your party there will be a lot of debate over how best to get there, from a requirement that Senator Lugar supports to maybe incentives. And I guess we don't necessarily care how we get there. We care that we get there, because otherwise we lock in these vehicles that live 10, 15 years and lock us into no consumer choice for the higher blends.
Yeah. I actually wrote an op-ed piece about this 2 or 3 years ago and proposed a mandate for that all new vehicles be flex fuel vehicles. And again, I go back to the whole issue of national security. There may be a time where, as we see Iran developing a nuclear weapon, where our access to Middle East oil is shut off for a period of time, maybe an extended period of time. We're going to have a vehicle fleet that's going to be able to run on fuels that are not petroleum-based fuels. So to me, this is, again, just going back to this is sheer preparedness. And not having your economy beholding to an area of the world that is a very suspect and dangerous area and very unstable area of the world, and is going to be more unstable. This administration does not seem to want to do anything to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. From what I've seen, the Israelis are doing their covert job very well with computer viruses and mysterious deaths of nuclear scientists in Iran. I don't know that for a fact. I just can assume that somebody is doing the job that we're not doing. But this president would like to talk to the Iranians. The Iranians will be happy to talk to you while they continue to build a nuclear weapon, just like the North Koreans did under Bill Clinton and then subsequently George Bush. They will get a nuclear weapon if we don't stop them. That's just the bottom line. And once they have a nuclear weapon, energy from the Gulf is going to be outrageously expensive, if available at all. And we have to have a country, because of the policy of this administration, that is prepared for that day. And obvious, and to me, it's very clear, flexible vehicle is at least the first of many things that we have to do to prepare for that. Again, thank you very much for inviting me to be here. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you again for the entrepreneurship that you've shown in an industry that is now increasingly vitally important for the future of our country. Thank you, and God bless you.